Sportsnet 960 NHL Insider Frank Saravelli, brought to you by South Trail Exports. With inventory shortages across the city, it's the perfect time to sell your vehicle for cash. Visit SouthTrailExports.com.
And Mr. Saravelli, as Frank joins us from Daily Faceoff, the NHL is officially back, my friend. What did you make of last night? And I know we still have another week or so to go until it's back here.
Another four years.
Yeah. Can you, you've got contacts. Can you talk to somebody about why that we're starting on a Saturday and the rest of the league is starting on a Tuesday?
Well, they just wanted to really build the suspense. I think that's really what it comes down to, is get Flames fans frothing at the mouth for Saturday's action, and then you'll be good.
and it certainly has worked to this point. I'll say that much. What'd you make of last night and the first two games of the season?
Honestly, hard to tell which was more impressive: Pittsburgh's win in Tampa, spoiling the banner ceremony, or the Kraken comeback. I kind of tend to lean towards the Kraken comeback, given what the last 40 or 48 hours were like for Seattle, getting a roster together and getting everyone on the ice and then stepping into the fortress, which is a little daunting in its own right. Plus all the hype and expectations of, can the Kraken do what the Golden Knights did a few years ago in their first season, to battle back from 3-0. I know they lost, but probably, you know, just one first game, but gave us a little bit of an indication as to what we'll see from Seattle this year.
What, because there was a lot of uncertainty as to what that roster was going to look like to start the game. There were players in COVID protocol. Then all of a sudden things changed for warm up. So what happened last night?
It was wild. So basically the longer story behind it is that the Kraken, well, first off, it was Cal Yarncroak a few days back that had tested positive and they knew would be out for a bit, a confirmed positive case. And then there were some close contacts that they were dealing with. Jamie Oleksiak was one, Jared McCann was another. And so they had this group of other players that were waiting, and I'm blanking on the third guy's name, that were waiting on some additional testing. And so they left those guys back in Seattle. And at that point, after Tuesday's morning skate, Dave Haxtell came out and said, look, these three guys are going to be unavailable for the first game. And so everyone was kind of like, whoa, that means that Seattle would then be, they'd have three guys as many as seven guys in that sort of $800,000-$900,000 payroll range, which the third guy that I was blanking on was Jonas Donskoy.
Right.
And all of a sudden you take all those guys out of the mix, and that's what you're thinking you're going to see from the Kraken. All of a sudden they tested out of the protocol. And I made a point to ask this question last night, sort of before the game started, because I was surprised, because I had heard Dave Haxtell's press conference saying those guys weren't available. Then they show up. Well, the NHL didn't bend the protocols here. There is no bend to these protocols. What happened was these players tested out of the protocol, finally got word that they were cleared. They hopped on a plane and ended up in Vegas just in time to get there and get ready. So I think something around 5 p.m. Pacific is when they had made their way into the rink. And they're in the lineup, all that hectic stuff going on. Obviously a little bit rattled to start, find their footing, and then are able to tie it up 3-3, going toe-to-toe for a while with one of the best teams in the league over the last number of years.
Yeah, it was certainly a cool comeback. It's too bad they weren't able to close it off, but I certainly think that is a nice way to start your NHL tenure, to do that in Vegas and have that type of outing in Vegas. I'm 100% with you, and you're right on the other side.
By the way, what'd you think of the jerseys? Those white jerseys are unbelievable.
I love them. We got to see them in person, actually, Frank, because Seattle came here to the Scotiabank Saddledome for a preseason game, and so I got to see them in person before their regular season debut. They're even better up close. Like, they are crisp. I love the colors. It still is a little strange seeing Mark Giordano wearing one of those jerseys and having the C on that jersey, but otherwise, they look good. And the Holmes, the homes look just as good. Like I can't wait for that debut too.
Everything's so well done. You know what I'm excited to see is what that environment and arena looks like. It's been kept under wraps, not only because they want to keep it a little bit of a secret and surprise, but they're actually still scrambling to get work done. I think they're hoping to have a tour later this week for media, but the home opener there is a little more, it's just about 10 days away,
yeah,
9 days away, and they are, it's full court press to get that arena and everything done in time for the first game.
Well, and the other thing that I noticed last night in Vegas, there was a good chunk of Seattle faithful there. I guess, can you be a faithful with only one game? But they traveled well. And I know Seattle-Vegas is a hop, skip, and a jump and not a long plane ride at all. But I was also surprised to see how many Kraken fans were on the road last night.
Honestly, the league is thrilled with the support that the Kraken have gotten. And it's not just the jersey sales and the records that they've broken on that front. It's not just the incredibly long season ticket wait list that's now in action, but just from a pure interest and revenue perspective, they're fully expecting to be one of the top 10 revenue producing teams in the league this year, which is much needed coming off of the pandemic and how that's affected business.
No doubt about it. And you mentioned right off the top, not sure what was more impressive, Seattle or Pittsburgh, and the Penguins spoiling Tampa's banner-raising ceremony, and they do so by giving it to them on the chin, 6-2. I won't lie, I've already had a couple of people chirping me on the text line today. We were doing our Great Expectations show yesterday, and I said Pittsburgh is the team that is most likely to disappoint, and I chose Mike Sullivan as my first coach to be fired. So there is my honesty, there is my disclosure. I'll give the Penguins credit. No Crosby, no Malkin to score six last night against that team. That was pretty impressive.
Hey, look, that's just one game. You have a lot of room left to be right, but I personally don't see it that way. I think it's all about for this team hanging on through the first number of weeks to really get their footing and get, you know, Tristan Jarry looked really good last night. You know, certainly a lot better than when we last saw him, and that confidence could go a long way for this team. You know, they do have some interesting decisions to face later on in the year, but there really won't be any decisions to make provided that they're in the mix. And the playoff track record that they have, 15 straight seasons with Sidney Crosby getting that team to the playoffs, like I'm not ready to count them out. I think Mike Sullivan is a fantastic coach, and I think you know, the only interesting thing about your prediction would be that he would just have so much more time to focus on Team USA and the Olympics if he is the first guy fired. My prediction was actually in St. Louis with Craig Berube. You know, he doesn't have an extension. This is the final year of his deal. A couple first-round exits in a row for a team that had expectations. And, yes, he delivered a Stanley Cup. Now this is the third season since then. I just, you know, for me, I think he's the guy that I have circled in terms of a coaching change.
You also, how about your Stanley Cup prediction over at Daily Faceoff? The Winnipeg Jets to win the Stanley Cup, Mr. Saravelli.
Believe it or not, I'm actually getting hammered by Jets fans. Like, why would you pick us? We don't want to be picked. We don't want the curse of Frank. Whatever Frank says, the opposite happens, at least in terms of predictions. I don't know that that's exactly true. One of my favorite stories of the year is actually taking these bold predictions that I've had and then going back in maybe like March or April, auditing them and figuring out which ones scored well and which ones didn't and which ones could still pan out. I've got a funny feeling about the Jets this year. I think they have that championship pedigree, that sort of swagger that exists. And I think whenever you have a guy like Connor Hellebuck in net, as well as he plays and as consistent as he's been, and the top six forward group that they have, the one thing that's been missing over these last number of years has been the defense and the depth on defense. And it's funny because just sort of reading through my basically my Twitter mentions and everything that's going on that front related to the Jets pick, people are looking at Winnipeg's decor and saying, well, they only have Josh Morrissey, Neil Pionk, Nate Schmidt, Brendan Dillon, Dylan DeMello, and Logan Stanley. Like, they're like, that's not a top six. And I'm like, maybe you should watch a little bit more closely. Josh Morrissey is a great shutdown player in this league. Nate Schmidt, when he's on, has the energy and excitement and the scoring ability and skating ability to really be an impact player. And like, people keep sleeping on Neil Pionk. Like, that guy has had two really good seasons in Winnipeg the last couple years. And I think a guy like Logan Stanley is going to only get better. So I don't know why more people aren't talking about the Jets. I haven't checked the sports books to see if there's been any impact on the cup predictions, but a 40-1 shot, like, I could pick a lot worse teams that have better odds.
Frank Saravelli is with us. Daily Faceoff, our Wednesday NHL Insider here on the Big Show on Sportsnet 960, The Fan. Frank, were you surprised to see Nashville and Matthias Ekholm re-up before the season?
Not surprised, because that's what they had been pushing for, that the Ekholm camp had made it clear to Nashville, it was either like, get him re-signed or we can revisit this after the trade deadline, because we're not talking extension in season. And when that kind of pressure is put upon you and you believe it to be real, well, I think that sort of lends itself to getting something done. Ekholm's name had been in trade rumors previously, going back to last season, before they got it together and UC Saros really helped push them into the playoffs. But it's a big raise for Ekholm. And what I like about it is that it's not incredibly long-term. It's that medium-term deal, $6.25 million, 4 years, total of 25, nice security and payday for him. And one of the real anchors of your defense, along with Roman Josi, is now locked up in a time of what really feels like transition for the Preds. They're a team that I'm sort of kind of trying to figure out where they're heading. I don't see them as a playoff team. I know a lot of other people don't as well. I just don't know how they make some of the changes. I feel like in some ways they're stuck in a similar pattern to what San Jose is in the Pacific. You know, you've got a few anchor contracts that are really difficult to deal, and you've got a very small or limited prospect base because your team had been good for a while and you haven't really been picking towards the top of the draft. And so Nashville is a franchise, same thing with San Jose, that had historically drafted pretty well. They just really haven't had the opportunity. They've missed on their late round picks. And, you know, when you've got a contract like Matt Duchene that's in place for five more years, like, that's really going to hurt.
Well, and that's why I was slightly surprised as well, because I had read the report about wanting to get it done before the season started, but I thought to myself, if you're Nashville, what's the better way to go about this? Do you re-sign him and have him in the fold? But I'm with you. I don't know if I see them being a playoff team anytime soon, or do you get the King's ransom you might be able to get for him in a trade? And that kind of really opens the door for the same type of conversation with Philip Forsberg too, doesn't it?
Well, but what I really like about the deal is that it doesn't preclude you from making that trade. I mean, when you think about it, teams crave cost certainty, right? Like, they crave knowing exactly what they're going to have. And not to suggest that Nashville is going to turn around now and trade Matthias Ekholm. I truly don't believe that to be their intention. But a year from now, a year and a half from now, when he's towards the latter part of that first season under the new deal.
Yeah.
I mean, what would stop? Like, that's the one big thing. Roman Josi is the only guy on the Preds that has a no move, no trade. Everyone else is free and clear. And that was, again, one of the sticking points, is David Poile always keeps all of his cards available to him to play. And in this case, you know, I don't see it being prohibitive at age 31 for Ekholm, now 32 when the deal starts, plays until he's 36. If he continues to play the way that he has, 6.25 seems somewhat reasonable to me. And I was taking the guesswork and the question mark out of what he gets paid next.
What do you feel, or what is the kind of buzz about Forsberg's future in Nashville?
Honestly, there hasn't been much buzz. I'd imagine at a certain point that they address that. He's sort of just there. He's had some good seasons and really was a driver on that team, and he's had other years where he's just sort of been, you know, fallen short of expectations. And I guess the big question mark is, which Philip Forsberg do we end up seeing from the Preds this year? If he ends up being the player of 2 or 3 years ago, well, then he's going to command either a lot of attention on the trade market or a pretty significant new deal. And at the age of 27 is sort of right in that range to really help teams.
Here we are right up on the edge of the start of the regular season, and Brady Tkachuk remains unsigned in Ottawa. What's going to cause that thing to move? What's going to need to happen for that deal to get signed?
One of two things. Either the Sens go above and beyond where they've been on the long-term deal, throw the bag of money on the table, the proverbial duffel bag or the Brinks truck, and they say, I know we were at this number on a 7 or 8 year deal, but with this plus this kind of structure and, you know, signing bonus or whatever the Tkachuk camp has been asking for, and I believe it's all those things, to really put it over the top and get the deal done, or they acquiesce and they say, you got us, we're not willing to do those things on the 7 or 8 year deal that we're looking for, and we're willing to go and do a 3 year deal now, and here's what the numbers look like. That's it. I mean, there's a philosophical divide, to my knowledge, in terms of what these two sides are looking for. And the only way to bridge that is for someone to move. And I just don't see it being Brady Tkachuk and his agent and uncle and Craig Oster.
Finally, your thoughts on Nick Suzuki signing his 8 year deal in Montreal yesterday, $63 million total.
I love this deal, and I saw a lot of people crushing it on social media saying, what an overpay. You know, look at some of these other deals that have been made. How is it possible that this player that hasn't played a full 82-game season is getting an AAV on a max-term deal just under $8 million? And actually, on our Daily Faceoff show, we had Steve Greeley on, the former assistant GM of the Sabres, and he gave a really interesting comparable. And he said, go look at Mark Scheifele's contract that he signed in 2016. It was $6.125 million. And obviously, to go from 6125 to 7875 with Suzuki, that's really just the difference in the cap between now and then. By and large, the cap percentage for those two guys is pretty close. And then you go back and you look at Mark Scheifele's production in his first 2 years. And if Suzuki can take that sort of next step this year, which I believe, and obviously the Canadians do as well, to get in that 60-point range with the assignments that he's taken on, the matchups that he's taken on,
yep,
the playoff prowess that he showed, I think that's a good bet. And you're buying all of the best years of Nick Suzuki starting at age 21, going all the way to 29, allows him some serious financial security, a chance to get another contract before the age of 30. And, oh, by the way, how about the fact that no one can offer sheet him?
Not bad. Not bad at all. It's a pretty good situation in that regard. And I was a pretty big fan of it yesterday. I wonder why more teams don't go down that same road, but I like that deal a lot for Montreal. Great stuff as always, Frank. Really enjoyed your chat with the boys in the morning yesterday. Always good to have you on Wednesday afternoons. We'll talk to you next week. Hey,
sounds good. Can't wait for the first Flames game on Saturday.